Orleans. A cemetery sits on the property, too, holding saints in the peaceful earth as they await resurrection. I have been to all 50 states in America, including Kentucky, but I have never been to this particular church. I have seen it online, but I do not ever want to visit in person. Somewhere in that graveyard, resting among the Baptist faithful, lay the remains of the uncle who abused me when I was 14 years old. When my mother sent me an email in January 2007 telling me he was dead, I replied, "Thank God." It was the first time that any mention of my uncle and any word of gratitude were ever combined in a sentence. Once in a while, I look at the graveyard from the safe distance of the Google cam, wanting, I think, to reassure myself that he remains in the dirt. Researchers say that negative emotions, fear, envy, greed, entitlement, resentment, anger, and regret, block gratitude, causing self-alienation, broken relationships, and profound unhappiness, thus resulting in a worldview that is deeply false to human nature and the nature of the universe, a distortion of reality. Indeed, it hardly takes a doctorate in psychology to know that what Christians refer to as the seven deadly sins, really seven deadly emotions, run counter to thanksgiving and get one to a wretched place of existence if left spiritually unchecked. At the same time, grateful people tend to be satisfied with what they have and are less likely to succumb to negative emotions. It is a bit of a therapeutic and theological gerbil wheel. Positive people are grateful, and grateful people are positive. Negative people are ingrates, and ingrates sink into a mire of maladjustment. The trick, according to this analysis, seems to be ridding yourself of your negative emotions. It is one thing to explore a family history of negative emotions, and it is a necessary part of maturity to take responsibility for the hurt you choose to embrace or the bad feelings you cultivate in your own life. But what if negative emotions stem from real sources and are not of your own doing, not your own fault? What if you fear not because of the prospect of losing what you have or never getting what you desire, but because your uncle used to invade your bedroom at night? What if you were angry because you have been violated and no one protected you? What if you regret the loss of your sense of personhood and safety, or resent that your life was interrupted by a sociopath? These are not just negative emotions. They are important feelings induced by trauma, violence, and abuse, and they are natural human responses to pain inflicted upon you. It would be much worse if a victim did not feel fear, anger, regret, and resentment. Negative emotions are not always our fault. Even so-called negative emotions like envy and greed have complex origins. An acquaintance shared a story with me of being bullied. When he was a boy growing up in West Texas, he thought he might be gay. Evidently, so did his classmates, who harassed him ruthlessly for being a sissy and pansy. At night, while crying himself to sleep, he would vow, "I'll show them. I'll be smarter and richer than all of them. Then they can't hurt me." It became his emotional mantra. He worked hard, put himself through college, left rural Texas, and became a successful investment banker. When still in his 30s, he bought a dream house in a posh California coastal town. "You know what I felt?" he asked. "Not grateful. I was mad that I didn't have a view of the beach. Some people might say that it was envy, but I was always the little boy trying to protect myself from the bullies. I never felt safe." He sighed. "It took me a long time to learn gratitude." For some people, gratitude can be very difficult. A classmate from my days at an evangelical college had a poster hanging, of all places, above the toilet in her bathroom. It depicted a cheerful garden and was emblazoned with words from the New Testament book of 1 Thessalonians. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. Honestly, I always wanted to rip it off the wall. I was secretly full of fury and injustice, not only the injustice I had suffered, but the larger agonies and evils endured by people less fortunate than even my own sorry self. But I knew that such an emotional insurrection would lead her to believe that Satan had possessed me, and it would result in all sorts of gossipy prayers for my salvation. So there it remained, taunting me like one of Job's tormentors every time I had to relieve myself. It is worth noting, write the authors of one gratitude study, in typically detached academic jargon, that while gratitude is considered a positive psychological factor, it is not necessarily good for all people under all circumstances, e.g., displaced gratitude under conditions of exploitation. No kidding. Put that on a poster, girlfriend. Telling victims to be grateful for trauma, violence, or abuse only wounds those who have suffered and empowers perpetrators. Gratitude may work miracles, but sometimes the miracle comes from just being able to feel anything but pain. Feeling thankful might just have to wait. Gratitude cannot and should never be forced or faked, and it is never appropriate to cover up or deny abuse or excuse injustice. Indeed, gratitude as a placebo can be another form of abuse that silences those in deep pain with false notions of forgiveness, happiness, and well-being. Emotions drive our lives, not from the back of a train, but often as the engine. Negative emotions and positive ones. Our lives are an intricate mix of feelings created through myriad circumstances, many of which are beyond our control. Some of our problems with feelings occur when we cannot embrace what is just there, when we fear or judge our own emotions. One of the most helpful teachings in Buddhism is the idea that suffering simply exists and that it is intensified by human refusal to acknowledge the reality of pain. Suffering actually increases when we resist, deny, or fear negative emotions. Those emotions often cause shame, and shame blocks gratitude. As human beings, part of our job is to be able to recognize what causes pain, to work toward healing, and to learn how to live in the world with empathy, forgiveness, and gratitude. Embracing our humanness, with its mixture of sadness and joy, fosters vulnerability and authenticity, and takes us toward maturity and deep love. Gratitude, writes Catholic theologian and justice activist Mary Jo Leddy, does not dispel the mystery of suffering and evil in the world, and may even deepen it. It is not easy to live with the mysteries of pain, injustice, illness, and violence. We humans rightly rage against these indignities, those things that work against joy, love, and peace. For decades, I wrestled with shame and hatred regarding my uncle. Those emotions were exacerbated by other incidents where I was rejected, hurt, or felt violated. The negative feelings were powerful, sometimes driving the train to what felt like the edge of an emotional cliff. Gratitude does not take that away. Gratefulness is no panacea against violence and injustice. Yet my soul suspected there might be a path beyond rage, a way for gratitude to enfold the pain in a greater good. These words from Catholic spiritual writer Henry Nouwen spoke to me. To be grateful for the good things that happen in our lives is easy, but to be grateful for all of our lives, the good as well as the bad, the moments of joy as well as the moments of sorrow, the successes as well as the failures, the rewards as well as the rejections. That requires hard spiritual work. Still, we are only truly grateful people when we can say thank you to all that has brought us to the present moment. As long as we keep dividing our lives between events and people we would like to remember and those we would rather forget, we cannot claim the fullness of our beings as a gift of God to be grateful for. Along the way, a friend, a person who herself had known suffering, said to me, "Your life is like a garden, and it is not well tended. You need to grow your garden." Until then, I had never really thought of the emotional life as a garden, an organic metaphor, but that is much closer to reality. Our emotional lives are like gardens. Experiences are akin to soil, the rich terroir in which our feelings grow. Left untended, certain emotions can choke out others, like the wild grasses that threaten my lettuces every spring. There is nothing inherently wrong with weeds. It's just that they get in the way of dinner. So I pay attention. I know the difference between the seedlings I plant and the invasive ones, cultivating the greens and pulling out what would make my family sick. So it is with our emotional lives. The same soil allows both weeds and desirable plants to grow, and it takes a watchful gardener, and more than a little practice, to ensure the health and productivity of the whole. I learned to work the garden and discovered that it was the spiritual work of gratitude. In a very real way, suffering is just the soil. From it grow both negative and positive emotions. The negative ones are like weeds in the high summer. The positive ones, including gratitude, too often the smallest of shoots. Over the years, I have discovered that hard work on one's knees is the surest way to tend the garden, both in prayer and in rooting around in the dirt of the soul. I recognize the difference between what is fruitful and what will inhibit the growth of goodness, and then pluck out the invasive species. But if the work is done, the garden flourishes, and their gratitude grows. I cannot remember a single moment when I was able to forgive. It did not work like that. Instead, I went on tending the garden, growing what could be grown and rooting out the weeds. Then, one morning, some 40 years after the fact, I woke up feeling sorry for my uncle. I thought about how he had gone to prison, how my aunt divorced him for emotional cruelty. I remembered how the pastor who buried him begged my mother to pay for a grave marker. She refused. I wondered what had wounded him so, why he had made the choices he made, and perhaps who had hurt him that he hurt others. What happened long before I was born? Had he been a victim too? I felt something. Pity, empathy, I don't know. But I saw him as a deeply flawed human being, not a monster. A person who had wasted his life, who had squandered the only real gift he had, lived bereft of hope and love, and lies in an unmarked grave. And I felt oddly grateful, not for his suffering or for the injustice done to me. No one should ever feel grateful for sin, evil, or violence. No one should ever express gratitude for the bad choices of others. Those bad choices are never gifts. I do not know if what I felt was forgiveness, but I experienced a profound sense of appreciation that my own pain had not taken the same form that his had. This suddenly seemed a miracle, as was the awareness that my life has been for the most part rewarding. A good family, strong faith, meaningful work, all the things that had eluded him. Somehow, I had found courage and conviction to make it through, and in midlife could say thank you to those around me, to the universe, to God. Gratitude had grown in that soil, good soil. It was not the dirt of shame. All the shit had only enriched the dirt. Somewhere in the earth, thanksgiving had taken root. From the ground had sprung life. Through seeding and weeding, the vine had come forth and its fruit had ripened. For that, my heart felt grateful. The gift. As an emotion, gratitude can be elusive, so easily blocked by regret, loss, anger, and fear. So I tried to keep a daily record of gratitude. When I did, however, I realized something important. I was filling the little yellow diary with things. A pleasant meal with my family, a surprise compliment, a new book contract, a car repair, my daughter's grades at college. My gratitude diary became a kind of list of the benefits of being a middle-class white person. It actually made me uncomfortable. I realized that I thought of gratitude as a commodity tally, a sort of positive emotional account of nice stuff. To pay attention to good things was a helpful practice, as it displaced negative attitudes related to entitlement and privilege, things that often blocked my ability to see my own life clearly. However, the diary missed what was revealed in my long struggle with abuse and what was most important. Gratitude at its deepest and perhaps most transformative level is not warm feelings about what we have. Instead, gratitude is the deep ability to embrace the gift of who we are, that we are, that in the multi-billion year history of the universe, each one of us has been born, can love, grows in awareness, and has a story. Life is the gift. When that mystery fills our hearts, it overwhelms us, and a deep river of emotions flows forth, feelings we barely knew we were capable of holding. At that moment, we might feel stunned. We might thank God. We might thank our ancestors and the random choices they made that created the line that led to us. Mom and Dad, the Big Bang, evolution, whatever. But we might also feel the transcendent awe of life that in the entirety of the cosmos, through the enormity of time, I am, you are, we all are. What we feel when we contemplate that feeling is gratitude. Life is the first gift, said poet Marge Piercy. Love is the second, and understanding the third. The first gift is life. My life, your life. There exists a unique beauty and dignity at the core of each one of us, the quality that animates every human being and that Jews and Christians call the image of God. That is the gift. No other gift is possible without it. Nothing we ever receive or have can rival it. Gratitude is not about stuff. Gratitude is the emotional response to the surprise of our very existence, to sensing that inner light and realizing the astonishing sacred social and scientific events that brought each one of us into being. We cry out like the psalmist, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. When we push aside the immediate anxieties of that existence, we can actually see more clearly that to feel fear, doubt, or anger at all is part of the gift of life itself. Without life, even the negative emotions are impossible. Everything else is dependent on that one thing. All we experience is radically contingent on a single gift, life. Few have understood this as thoroughly as Elie Wiesel, Holocaust survivor and novelist, as here in an interview with Oprah Winfrey, herself an abuse survivor. Oprah, there may be no better person than you to speak about living with gratitude. Despite all the tragedy you've witnessed, do you still have a place inside you for gratefulness? Elie, absolutely. Right after the war, I went around telling people, thank you just for living, for being human. And to this day, the words that come most frequently from my lips are, thank you. When a person doesn't have gratitude, something is missing in his or her humanity. A person can almost be defined by his or her attitude toward gratitude. Oprah, does having seen the worst of humanity make you more grateful for ordinary occurrences? Elie, for me, every hour is grace, and I feel gratitude in my heart each time I can meet someone and look at his or her smile. This insight stands out. When people lack gratitude, something is missing in their humanity. People can almost be defined by their attitude toward gratitude. Wiesel is not speaking of appreciating material goods. He means that our ability to experience life as a gift, to treasure that gift, and to feel its power, even in the most violent and demeaning of circumstances, is the very essence of human existence. Life is the gift, not what we have, but that we are. To feel gratitude is not the caboose of some faith train. It is the beginning. To feel appreciative awareness of our own lives and feel that awareness of the lives of all those around us is rather like being reborn. As we look at ourselves, our experiences, and the world with eyes of surprise and wonder, pay attention to those who have suffered and who found gratefulness. Listen to the voices and songs of the marginalized, the thanksgivings of those who have been abused and oppressed. Embrace the sorrows of your own heart. These are the teachers of gratitude. Do not be afraid. Is there a word that captures the characteristics of a grateful person? Asked psychologist Philip Watkins. In the midst of data points and research citations in his academic textbook, a startling statement appears. I believe there is a word that helps answer the question, he opined. For me, that word is grace. Grateful people are full of grace. Grateful people feel life to be a gift. Every hour is grace, said Elie Wiesel. Yes, an amazing grace and a gift. Part 2. Me, Ethics. Awareness and Practice. Thank you is the best prayer that anyone could say. I say that one a lot. Thank you expresses extreme gratitude, humility, understanding. Alice Walker. Chapter 3. Habits of Gratitude. Gratitude unlocks the fullness of life. It makes sense of our past, brings peace for today, and creates a vision for tomorrow. Melody Beattie. The sign outside read Trinity, and a stylized dove hovered above the logo formed from a Celtic cross and triangle. Underneath the picture, the line read, "Assemblies of God." I wandered into the small church on my own, no friend, no family to accompany me. I was only 17, following the path of life's first spiritual journey, and I had no idea that the Assemblies of God was a Pentecostal denomination, a group emphasizing the power of God through gifts like speaking in tongues and miraculous healing. I was not looking for any of that, however. I was just curious about church. The sanctuary was simple, more like a cafeteria with carpet and nice chairs than any traditional church. Although the building was new, the congregation was not small. Many people filled the seats as a professional-sounding band played music to warm up the crowd. The preacher, in a business suit, an odd choice of vestment for an Arizona summer, stood up. "Welcome," he shouted. "Welcome to God's house. Let's all thank Jesus for bringing us here. Get up, stand up, thank Jesus." The music swelled and people swayed, some chanting in a language that sounded like Latin to me, but full of strange intonations, maybe Chinese. The pastor pointed at a woman in the congregation. "What do you thank Jesus for today?" And the reply, "That my mother was healed." He shouted back, "Praise Jesus." He pointed again, "And you?" The response was tearful. "God paid my electric bill." "Yes," cried the preacher. "Thank you, Jesus." The music went on, a soft rock litany of "Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus." "Oh, yes," the pastor shouted, now needing no prompt from the congregation. "Thank you, Jesus. We all thank you. We praise you and thank you." It was like a spiritual sea, full of waves of praise as all around me, people with eyes half open, joined their words to his, as if mesmerized by gratitude, first gently whispering thanks and then shouting praise. From every direction flowed thanks, appreciation for miracles received, prayers answered, healings bestowed, financial provision, good weather, missionaries in foreign lands, heathens converted, children who spoke in tongues, the pastor's recent sermon, and all who came to paint the new church. Hands were raised, palms facing up, waiting to receive the gifts of a good God. Lips were ready with eager words of thanks. Everyone awaited grace, overwhelmed by gratitude. Everyone except me, of course. I felt nothing. Well, that is not entirely true. I was bewildered by this polyphony of appreciation. Maybe a bit angry, as I felt left out of their thanksgivings. My teenage prayers were not being answered. I had not been healed. I struggled with migraine headaches. I did not share their secret praise language. It would be nice to be special. I was not rich, quite the contrary, was not popular, the main woe of being 17, had no boyfriend, wondered about love, sex, and college, and feared the rapture, the end times, and the war of Armageddon. I had nothing but a pile of teenage worries and fears, heightened by reading the Book of Revelation and the late great planet Earth, a scary paperback that I had bought at the local grocery store. All these happy people proclaiming the good things God had done for them, all this thanks, made me dizzy. The room seemed sweaty with gratefulness. Then the pastor started pointing at people in my section. "What are you thankful for? And you?" Thankful. I was terrified he might ask me. I slipped out of my seat and headed for the door. When I reached the car with its Jesus bumper sticker, an icon of my newfound faith, I breathed and sighed. "Thanks, Jesus, for getting me out of there." Thank you. An ethic of thanks. It might have been the first time I felt like a stranger in a room of Thanksgiving, but it would not be the last time I ran away when called upon to render thanks. That, of course, is the problem with gratitude as a feeling. We resist feelings. We might not be feeling the same thing everyone else is. Or, as in my case, gratitude might only show up once we have escaped to the parking lot. Emotions are random things. Love, sadness, joy, fear. Very few are predictable, and most move like winds through our lives. They depend on what we have eaten or how long we have slept, long-term problems, and immediate circumstances. I suspect that is why my evangelical friends put feelings at the end of their faith train. Emotions are ephemeral. Feeling is great when you feel good, but what about when you do not? Or when your feelings run counter to those of everyone else in the room. Gratitude is like other emotions. Thankfulness might sneak up by surprise, but it cannot be planned. Yet gratitude is good. Think of all the benefits that scientists report. Health, happiness, and well-being. So the question arises, how do you experience gratitude when feelings are elusive? Part of the answer lies in the nature of gratitude itself. It cannot be overstated that gratitude is an emotion, a complex set of feelings involving appreciation, humility, wonder, and interdependence. Gratitude is, however, more than just an emotion. It is also a disposition that can be chosen and cultivated, an outlook toward life that manifests itself in actions. It is an ethic. By ethic, I mean a framework of principles by which we live more fully in the world. This ethic involves developing habits and practices of gratefulness that change us for the better. Gratitude involves not only what we feel, but also what we do. In this way, gratitude resembles love. Love is also a complex set of feelings, desire, passion, devotion, and affection. We feel love. But love is also a commitment, a choice, and a vow, an emotional orientation toward a person or persons that causes us to act in certain ways. Love, as a noun, a feeling, surprises us. It shows up and changes everything. As most of us know, however, it is also a bit of a cheat. It can disappoint, fade, or taunt when it seems to hide or move away. Love as a noun can be tricky. When it is, we choose, often motivated by the memory of the feelings, to love and act accordingly. Love moves from being a noun, an emotion we feel, to a verb, an ethic of commitment we embrace. Gratitude is like that. Some amount of the time we feel grateful, but when the emotions seem to desert us or show up at all the wrong times and in the wrong places, we can choose to give thanks and act in accordance with grace. Gratitude is both a noun and a verb. Gratitude is both a feeling and a choice. The first often arises unannounced, and the second takes a lifetime of practice. To compare love and gratitude underscores one of the most important things about gratefulness. It is ultimately about connection. Most typically, we feel grateful when someone does something for us. We discover that we are, in some way, unable to meet our own needs. That may make us feel humble, but it also should inspire us to act in return. Not only should we say thank you to the benefactor, we should reach out toward other people in need. To live gratefully involves a number of skills, noticing when a kindness is done or a benefit is received, returning the gift of thanks to the giver or embrace the sense of awe instilled, and sharing benefits with others as we are able. Like love, gratitude multiplies through giving and receiving. Both love and gratitude can become far more than ephemeral emotions. With practice, they become habits. More than anything else, love and gratitude take time to learn, understand, and develop. Only in this process can we experience deep gratitude. Cultivating awareness. How does gratitude move from feelings to a disposition of character, from an emotion to an ethic? Perhaps the first task is to be aware of blessings. Brother David Stendhal Rast, a Benedictine monk, noted for a lifetime of gratitude practice, has observed, 99% of the time, we have an opportunity to be grateful for something. We just don't notice it. We go through our days in a daze. Being in a daze is essentially living on autopilot. We follow habitual paths of emotions and actions, the familiar routines and rituals that make up our daily existence. All our life, claimed psychologist William James in 1892, so far as it has definite form, is but a mass of habits, practical, emotional, and intellectual, systematically organized for our weal or woe, and bearing us irresistibly toward our destiny, whatever the latter may be. One of the most helpful books I have read in recent years is Charles Duhigg's The Power of Habit. In it, he explores the findings of neuroscience showing how much of our activity is habitual, based in a cycle of cues, routines, and rewards that form the well-worn brain pathways of daily existence. These are simple things, like your morning ritual of waking up, getting out of bed, drinking coffee, checking your smartphone, and seeing that your favorite team won the game or not. We do not think about these things. We just do them, as William James would say, semi-mechanically, or with hardly any consciousness at all. For many of us, gratitude is not a habit. We have few cues to initiate routines of gratefulness and do not regularly experience its rewards. Many people are far more cued into habits of frustration, like when a car cuts them off on a morning commute, or an opinion expressed offends them, which results in the reward of feeling superior or in control, or habits of anger, sadness, or cynicism. It seems we have more cultural tendencies towards these habits of woe than towards those James calls habits of weal, or well-being. Thus developing cues to actually initiate thankfulness and establish a routine is a way to foster gratitude. Most gratitude books and websites urge readers to do things like keep a daily gratitude journal, write thank you letters to important people in their lives, meditate, pray with gratitude beads, create rituals of thanksgiving, and do good things for others in need. But they also recommend establishing cues, like when you wake up, before a meal, last thing at night, or on Sunday afternoon. Cues remind us to look for blessings, awareness, at particular times or places, engage in routine gratitude activities, actions, in relation to those cues, and notice how we experience positive emotions that result, rewards. Social scientists and medical professionals call these gratitude interventions, replacing negative habits that cause emotional harm with more positive ones. Such interventions have been found to increase health and well-being among patients with a wide variety of physical and mental illnesses. The use of these techniques is becoming more widespread by those interested in personal spirituality and by professionals seeking good outcomes for clients and patients. But there is a downside to these findings. The interventions are often part of short-term studies, and even experts acknowledge that we do not yet have clear evidence about the success of gratitude techniques for the longer term. Can interventions turn into long-term habits, routine pathways of grace? As I read about the benefits of gratitude, I kept thinking about the problems associated with losing weight. Most people can maintain a weight loss routine for a month, maybe 3 or 6. As long as they stay on such a diet, they lose weight. As soon as the routine ends, however, many people regain the weight. Good diets, however, are not short-term routines. Instead, a good diet introduces people to more nutritious food, exercise, and emotional balance. It stops being merely a diet and becomes a new way of life. A good diet changes one's life, yet making the shift from a quick fix to the long-term habit of healthy eating is surprisingly hard. It seems that gratitude interventions may be similar. Successful as long as you keep the journal or remember to write the letters. But as soon as those end, it is easy to go back to the old pattern. How do we sustain awareness over the long term? Is it possible to become a more aware person? Can Thanksgiving become a habit? An accidental habit. My first job out of graduate school was teaching theology and church history at a small Christian college in Santa Barbara, California. It was not a happy experience. Although my credentials and qualifications were strong, the community also expected a certain kind of conformity in regard to doctrine and personal piety that discomforted me. For 4 years, and in the midst of a divorce, I struggled not only with conflicting expectations of who they wanted me to be and who I was, but also with a hostile tenure committee. After a lengthy process of evaluation, the president called me to his office. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm going to have to let you go." "Why?" I asked. "Your work is wonderful. You are an excellent teacher," he assured me, "but you just don't fit here." He looked at me sadly and then continued with a kind of patriarchal assurance. "You just don't fit. This wouldn't be a good place for you. One day you will thank me for this." Thank him? I wanted to throttle him. In less than 2 months, I would be without a job and a paycheck with few prospects for work in a weak academic job market. Being grateful to the person who put me in this position was the last thing in my mind. A week later, I was telling a friend about the exchange at that final meeting. "Can you imagine the nerve of him? That one day I'll thank him? What kind of nonsense is that?" I expected my friend to rush to my defense. Instead, he leaned back in his chair and quietly said, "You know, he's right." "What?" "Years ago," he continued, "I lost a job. It was painful, and I was angry. It didn't seem like a favor. But eventually, it was the event that made me understand that I was an alcoholic, and that led me to get sober. Eventually, I understood that it was what I needed for my life to change, not that it was easy." I looked at him. "I'm not an alcoholic. That's not the problem here." "I get that," he said. "But we all need to look at ourselves more honestly to figure out who we are and where we're really heading, to correct course. Sometimes that only happens in circumstances like this. One day, I bet you will thank him." "Did you? Thank the guy who fired you?" "Yes," he replied. "I did. But not at first. Mostly I wanted to throw him off a cliff. But yes, I did thank him, years later, after I learned gratitude." "You can learn gratitude?" I asked. "Isn't that just a feeling? How do you do it? Tell me one thing you are thankful for. Just one." I struggled. I could think of about 100 things that frightened and worried me. Finally, I blurted out, "For my friend Julie."
"That's the beginning," he replied.
"Think of one thing each day.
Do that. Just one.
Write it down in a journal." Journaling sounded beneficial. So for 3 years, I kept a daily journal as a general practice. At the beginning, most of the journal was complaint, but I followed my friend's advice and remembered to write down one blessing each day, no matter what. It was not easy. As the months unfolded, however, the balance began to shift. Sometimes there were two or three blessings to write down, and then more. There were days of outright surprise and joy, appreciation for simple pleasures, for the kindness of others, for the richness of life. One such entry stands out for me. I went out with Jay and told her about two things, about winning the dissertation prize and about that meeting where none of my colleagues would speak to me. She said, "You know, Diana, I've never seen anything like your life. People hand you a bouquet of roses in one hand and a bag of manure in the other." Funny enough, I hadn't really noticed that. I was so excited about the roses that I had barely thought twice about the cruelty. Maybe it does make a difference to pay more attention to the flowers than the crap. I wrote about the painful events connected with losing my first job and the divorce. But I also wrote about good things. Beautiful California days, meals with friends, music at a favorite jazz club, sitting at the beach, writing poetry, receiving professional praise and recognition. As the months unfolded, the tone changed from mostly desperation to mostly delight. A larger narrative emerged. What had begun as a period of difficult personal crisis wound up being a time of profound happiness, deepened courage, and new self-awareness. When my friend suggested writing down what I was thankful for, he suggested an activity that, as I mentioned, is known as a gratitude intervention in the healthcare community. Now, as evidence mounts that journaling about blessings instead of challenges reduces stress and improves moods, psychologists and medical professionals suggest that patients keep gratitude diaries. Indeed, keeping a gratitude journal is one of the most often recommended ways for people to learn gratefulness, and several popular books attest to its power. Although I did not start out to specifically keep a gratitude journal, the act of journal writing itself, along with my friend's mandate for one blessing a day, became a cue to notice the good things in my life. Putting those things on a page became a routine. As the pages added up day after day, I literally started seeing my life and the world differently. Over time, this habit became a lifeline for me. As I wrote, I knew that I grew stronger, and I developed a clarity of purpose and experienced more joy. This process was not a magic bullet, like a 21-day diet promising perfect health. I did not begin journaling and discover that all of my problems had gone away. Journaling was not a technique for happiness. Instead, over 3 years, I developed a sustained practice that shifted my perspective. I learned to see differently, and as a result, acted in ways that were more forgiving, just, and hopeful. In the process, I learned two important things. First, when you look for things to be grateful for, you will find them. And second, once you start looking, you discover that gratitude begets more gratitude. Like all habits, gratitude builds on itself. Gratitude is not the only emotional response to random experiences, but even in the darkest times of life, gratitude waits to be seen, recognized, and acted upon more thoughtfully and with a sense of purpose. Gratitude is a feeling, but it is also more than that. And it is much more than a spiritual technique to achieve peace of mind or prosperity. Gratitude is a habit of awareness that reshapes our self-understanding and the moral choices we make in the world. In short, gratitude is an ethic, a coherent set of principles and practices related to grace, gifts, and giving that can guide our lives. From technique to practice. Techniques are practical methods of accomplishing a task, some of which are better than others. We learn all sorts of techniques as we go through life. There are techniques for reading and studying, doing math, driving, managing money, raising children, making meals, maintaining commitments, and caring for our physical or emotional lives. Human beings use techniques to make tasks easier and allow us to accomplish work in at least somewhat organized ways. A healthy person learns these techniques from parents at school or in a religious community. Most of us, however, do not become experts at the techniques in all areas. We are not simultaneously a teacher, mathematician, investment banker, child psychologist, five-star chef, or our own personal doctor. Techniques provide us with a basic level of capabilities to function in life with a modicum of success. Practices take us more deeply in a particular activity. For example, when I was a girl, my mother taught me how to cook, how to shop for food, read recipes, and prepare ingredients, how to boil, fry, and bake. She gave me a set of techniques that enabled me to make meals and feed myself, and later on, a family. But I also enjoyed cooking. So I read cookbooks, watched cooking shows, and took over the kitchen with culinary experiments. Soon my kitchen skills outstripped my mother's. I moved from knowing a few basic techniques to being a confident and skilled home cook. I learned how to prepare food in interesting ways, how to combine surprising flavors and spices, and how to work with ingredients I had not known in my childhood. I practiced cooking, and it became an important part of my life, something that gives me joy, and I taught my daughter the same. Cooking together introduced our family to gardening, farmers markets, issues of food justice, and environmentalism. I will never open a restaurant or win Top Chef, but I am a good cook. Techniques are what we use to make do and survive. Practices move us to who we become and how we thrive. Not every technique we learn will turn into a practice, but some will. So it is with gratitude. Most of us did not completely fail at learning the basic techniques of gratitude. Even if we struggled with writing thank you notes to our grandparents, many of us learned common courtesies, like saying thank you to someone who holds a door or serves us in a restaurant or bringing a small gift of appreciation to a dinner party, as well as ways of celebrating Thanksgiving Day or donating a thank offering in a religious community. Such small acts make life more pleasant and connect us to others as we recognize daily considerations or gifts. We know enough of gratitude to function. But the techniques of thankfulness also hint at something else, that gratitude might be more than a set of skills, something we do on occasion. It can become a good habit. If we practice gratefulness, it becomes a natural and normal way of engaging the world. With gratitude, our hearts open toward one another. It can make us different and help us prosper. The habit can shape who we are. Past, present, future. Practice takes time. But that is not the only relationship between time and gratitude. When gratitude becomes a habit of being, our capacity to see time, past, present, and future, actually changes. Not only does gratitude open hearts, it also gives us new perspectives on our own lives. It stretches through our experiences, past, present, and future, creating a fabric of appreciation and awareness that forms the story of our lives. When we are thankful for the blessings of what was and see the goodness of what is, what can be comes into view with greater hope and possibility. Filmmaker Jean-Pierre Rigas learned this firsthand. The son of a hardworking single mother, he never appreciated how much she had sacrificed for him. "I was so mean to my mom growing up about having no money," he confessed. When she was fired from her job at age 75, she became depressed. Jean-Pierre wanted to help. He asked her for her bucket list, the list of everything she had ever dreamed of doing but never could. Belatedly showing his gratitude, correcting himself for his thanklessness, the son gifted his mother with all of the adventures on her list, including milking a cow, taking a hip-hop lesson, flying to her native England to visit her sister's grave, walking the Boston Marathon route. His mother rallied, saying, "I've never felt younger. I've never felt more loved." Through gratitude, he saw the past differently. "What was I doing? What an idiot," he admitted. She experienced new hope for the future. "I'm excited about going and seeing the next chapter," she said. And together, they found a deeper love in the present. Reframing their relationship through gratefulness changed them. Past, or hindsight. Gratitude is affected by memory. In some cases, gratitude may be blocked by the memory of negative events. Unable to let the past go, we might be caught up in anger or fear, stuck in events that limit the ability both to feel grateful and to develop the moral capacity of gratitude. In one experiment, researchers discovered that negative memories actually fostered negative moods, while positive memories elevated moods. As Jean-Pierre learned, recalling the past through the eyes of thankfulness strengthened gratitude in the present. Remembering episodes that gave rise to Thanksgiving is a good way to reflect on the long story of your life. Gratitude cannot change the past, but it can help us understand the past in ways that give joy and help us flourish. Oddly enough, most of us have something called positive recall bias. We tend to remember good things more than we remember bad things. We look backward with rose-tinted glasses, seeing the past as better than it actually was. This is not always a good thing, however, because it can become mere nostalgia. Although it might be pleasant to indulge in nostalgia while at a reunion with your high school friends, nostalgia draws unrealistic pictures of the past. It makes us believe the old days were always better, and what happened in the past is always preferable to the present and the future, that life's only blessings are long gone, and we can only be grateful for what was. So although we need to recall episodes of gratitude from the past, such memories need to be balanced and honest. We need to remember when gratitude arose from failures, not just successes. For Jean-Pierre, that was the challenge of being poor and needing to see that in a new way. For me, it was when the college president said to me, "One day you will thank me for this." He was essentially telling me that in the future I would recall that awful moment and realize it was the source of new strength and purpose. A bad episode would result in gratitude. That is exactly what happened. Now, 25 years later, I think, what would have happened if I had stayed in that job? There may have been benefits, but I would have been stuck in a place that limited me intellectually and religiously, ultimately a dead end. Freed from that particular job, however unjust it felt, I found my life opened up to people, places, ideas, and experiences that could otherwise never have happened. I learned new things about myself, about God, about life,
all of it possible only because I was fired. I feel thankful. Honest hindsight does not foster nostalgia. It puts us in touch with gratitude.